Hoy Mets fans, welcome back to Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World Series. My name is Brian, with me as always is Chris. And Chris, we have been doing this show together for, I think it's been like 7 or 8 years now, which is insane. But for most of those 7 or 8 years, as well as most of our lives, as well as most of the Mets' history, the Mets won on opening day. So happy day after opening day. Do you ever feel confident on opening day, or are we such Mets fans that we are still we still have doubts even on their most successful day historically?
I have opening day confidence. I'm very comfortable with it. It's just something that makes no sense, and you can't really attribute it to anything. I don't think the Mets are particularly adept at setting their roster and lineup for one game of the year, but it is a fun thing that they're the best at it, and it's not even really particularly close. So I tend to go into it with an optimistic feel, which is good. It would be very, unenjoyable if they were the worst team ever on opening day,
yeah,
and set expectations accordingly. But it's nice, even with this tiny sliver of the season behind them, as is the case every year, it is nice to have a share of first place, even now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there are a lot of things that will happen over the course of the year that will make us all go crazy and will be very, very frustrating. But there's something about just being at, you know, knowing at the end of opening day that, all right, we did it again. We're off to a good start. And I think yesterday it especially felt cathartic to win because of what happened right before the game. We should get right into that, which is it was announced that Justin Verlander was starting the season on the IL. It's funny. I had been doing Amazing Avenue stuff, Home Run Applesauce stuff, like all morning. And then I had to run out of the house to do a couple of things. And as soon as I got out of the house, I saw a Verlander like tweet from a friend. But I was like, you know what? I have to put my nose down and get the stuff done. I have to get done because I have to be back for opening day. And so I didn't see it for like 45 minutes. And going back on my timeline, it was like watching people do the stages of grief in real time because I got to see it all from a little bit of a distance. And it was, you know, I think people were obviously very upset and very concerned. And at the end of it, people were like, huh, it'll be all right. And, you know, you never know with an injury to a 40-year-old pitcher what the result's going to be. It is a low-grade strain of the teres major, which if you knew what that was before yesterday, congratulations, you know more about the human anatomy than I do. But, you know, Verlander was very clear that he feels this is minor, that he would work through this if it was later in the season and there was a season on the line. And he also said that he's going to continue to throw during this. That's the part that I am a little bit, I don't want to say uncomfortable about, because honestly, I don't want to say I'm a doctor because I'm not. But if you're trying to give your older pitcher some time to recoup from a minor injury, I would feel better if he was just shut down for a week even and then let him ramp back up. But anyway, that's getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here. How do you feel about this injury? How do you feel about the fact that he'll be throwing throughout?
I'm with you on the continuation of throwing. It just doesn't seem to make too much sense. I am not a doctor like you and just about everybody else who heard that news yesterday. I didn't know exactly what that body part was. When you look at it on the diagram, it's like, oh, maybe I've heard that before myself. I don't know.
Right.
So at the risk of being a little too cautiously optimistic, I guess similar to how I would treat something with Scherzer, I want to trust the veteran pitcher that he knows his body, came to the team with just the fact that it felt a little bit off, got checked out, no major injury was revealed, and you know, it's far more important that they have Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander healthy in September, October than today. So all of that being said, I want to think that he'll be back maybe just a couple turns through the rotation. And I guess I'm just going to not try to let the other possibilities weigh on me too heavily until we get there, right? That's on brand. It just kind of waiting until there's actual news to react to it. It would help a lot if McGill does his sort of, I think it's become a bit of an annual tradition of looking like an ace in April.
Yes.
And ultimately finishing the season with an ERA closer to 5 than 1. maybe he can step in and not do what Verlander is capable of doing, but just keep things afloat and take it from there. So, yeah, I don't know. Again, not a doctor on the still throwing part. I'm not sure what the benefit is there. I would assume there's some types of treatment, you know, physical therapy, that kind of a thing that he'd be doing to get back to where he's feeling normal. But yeah, I guess let's just hope that between him and the doctors that are directing this plan, that they know what they're doing in allowing him to throw at all.
Yeah, it just, you know, I've heard this song too many times before, where it's like, everything's fine, he'll be shut down for a week, and then it's, you know, it's 2 weeks later, oh, you know, it's still not where it should be, we're gonna transfer him to the 30-day or whatever, and then it's August, and he's coming off the IL for the first time. It just seems like that's the way the Mets have often operated with these things, which is just this not, you know, taking it too easy at first, and then eventually getting to a place where it's more serious. Maybe we all should have been reacting more seriously the whole time. So I'm trying to not fall directly into that old pattern, but I do think that shutting him down completely for a week or so would be my choice if I were in charge of this. But again, not a doctor. So you mentioned McGill making the start. You know, McGill had a really great start to his season last year when he was throwing much, much harder than he had been throwing before. That led to an injury, and it led to him being not so great later on in the season, as you mentioned. This is a tough line to walk with McGill, because on one hand, you want the player to be as successful as the player can be for you. On the other hand, you cannot expect anybody to put their safety, their health at risk for baseball games, because it's not worth it. And I think anyone with a brain would agree with that. So if McGill is not up to his, you know, April of 2022 stature, the Mets have a couple of options in the minors to help. One of those options is starting the season on the disabled list. Eliezer Hernandez will not be ready to go, at least for a little while. What was that? The day before the season started? Wednesday that was announced that he was hitting the IL?
Tuesday, I believe Wednesday, so.
Somewhere in the ballpark.
Yeah.
And it's a strained shoulder. I don't believe they gave a real sense of how long that was going to take to get healed. And then we get past him. I guess we're looking at maybe Dylan Bundy, who the Mets signed since we last recorded, to a minor league deal, the former Orioles pitcher, who actually was not terrible for the Angels last year, but, you know, was certainly not someone who's going to light the world on fire. So my question for you, Chris, is just, you know, is this the time to go out and make a trade? Is this the time to sign some more depth? Is this the time to take a chance on somebody who maybe wouldn't have been this high on our depth chart? Is it Joey Lucchese season? You know, sort of what do you see as the next move to make sure the Mets have enough pitching depth to get through the early part of the season?
Yeah, granted, when it comes to signing Dylan Bundy to a minor league deal, it's not the kind of move that's going to drastically change the outcome of what happens to the Mets this year. And it's not one that I was advocating for in mid-February, but by the time we knew that Quintana had an injury, and that wasn't that far into spring training, it just seemed like, hey, maybe some of those guys who are out there on minor league deals and have major league experience with decent track records, maybe bring them in and have them around, because what was concerning to me, and I think I said this last week too, is that one pitcher goes down, okay, you have an option or several options with McGill, Lucchese, Eliezer Hernandez, although he, it's temporarily unavailable because he started the year on the injured list, although that's one of those where it's kind of hard to know if that's actually the case or if they just didn't quite want to make him go to Syracuse yet.
Right.
But when you start to get more than one of the pitchers from that group in there, and David Peterson obviously would count as a member of that group, I thought it was interesting how optimistic Lucas was in writing up a bold prediction of him this week. It just, as someone who, I don't want to say I'm a David Peterson hater or anything, but I would think objectively that if everybody were healthy, that he would be sixth on their pitching depth chart, maybe.
Right.
So, look, there's an opportunity for these guys to impress. I do think that the Mets offense, as much as people might have been down on it at the end of last year because of the wild card series and the last couple weeks of the season, objectively, is just really good at getting on base, pretty good at scoring runs. Gary Cohen pointed out on the broadcast yesterday that they had finished fifth in runs scored last year. That's not something that we're typically used to as Mets fans, and they've only had more time to adjust to having a designated hitter on a permanent basis, which I think all National League teams probably needed a little bit of time to do. It's easy to say, okay, we're going to just rotate guys in and out of that position or whatever, but the Mets went and got an actual designated hitter who's good at hitting. But before I go too far off on that tangent, I do think the combination of a very competent major league lineup that should be in the top tier of scoring again, and these types of pitchers can work, ideally not on a super long-term basis, but you just hope that there's not one other tweak. Even now, when you look at the rotation, I'm very excited for Sango's first start.
Yep.
And I think Carlos Carrasco is probably a little bit underrated. Yep. But there is that little question mark where he missed one scheduled spring training start in a minor league game last Thursday. He made one this Tuesday, I think it was. So that was an instance where the Mets said, oh, hey, he's doing some elbow maintenance, right, last week. And then,
yep.
But don't worry, he's going to go out and pitch on Tuesday. And then that did happen. But if a third pitcher were to need somebody to temporarily fill in for them, that seems like the logical guy to have to worry about right now, just because of that. So, yeah. I don't think they're anywhere near having the season go off the rails because of these things, but I'd really like to keep it to one depth pitcher in the rotation at any given time. Two's not super comfortable. Three would start to feel like there might be a problem. And we do know that even as someone who advocates for very talented players, regardless of how old they may be in baseball years, that the Mets came into the season with an older rotation, mm-hmm. on average. So, I don't know. I don't want to be too down on any of these guys individually, but I feel like Dylan Bundy, for whatever reason, is the one that would probably have the best stretch for the Mets, and that's really just a notch down from what Carrasco is giving you. Steady innings. He doesn't walk too many guys, doesn't strike out too many guys. Carrasco is better in the strikeout category than he is, but just somebody who, to use that baseball cliche, you know, keep you in the game, give you a chance to win, that kind of a thing. And I guess my last thought on this group of these depth guys, one thing that I had looked at this year, I thought David Peterson had a lot of meltdowns last year, sort of in the mold of Steven Matz, where you just atrocious starts and then good ones mixed in, but there weren't that many super high peaks or that many actual meltdowns. He had a lot of starts where he didn't go deep into the game.
Yes.
Which is an issue, you know, 3 innings, 3 2/3, four, you know, whatever, fewer than 5 innings kind of thing. But he really only had one start where he got one out and gave up a bunch of runs. And in my memory, he had done that like 5 times. So
well, it's funny you said that. I had the exact same recollection of David Peterson's 2022 season, and I went through his game logs on Baseball Reference the other day, and what eventually came out was that, oh no, he just had a lot of really frustrating innings. Like, he would have an inning where he'd walk two people and give up 3 hits and have 2 runs scored on him, but the rest of the game he'd be fine. So it wasn't right. He didn't have these blow-up games, he had these blow-up innings, which would lead to short performances, but it is different than what you and I both remember that being.
Yeah. So, hey, look, he starts tonight in Miami. I think while they're not anywhere near as bad as the Nationals, the Marlins are not exactly a powerhouse, so it's not a bad team to get that first real start of the season under your belts and see where things can go from there.
Yeah. We should also mention that earlier this week, the Mets DFA'd Darren Ruff, which was something I think no one expected them to actually follow through and do. You know, look, trades don't work out sometimes, but this trade spectacularly didn't work out. We've talked about this before, but J.D. Davis basically became J.D. Davis again as soon as the trade happened. They also gave up some pitching depth with it. Again, no one that's, I think, is going to ever really come back to bite the Mets, but Darren Ruff trade was just an atrocious one at the end of at the end of the trade deadline, where people were expecting big moves, and the big move was Darren Ruff. And I've said this 100 times before, if you play 100 half seasons of baseball, Darren Ruff will never have another half season as bad as he had last year. I truly believe that. But I still think this was the right move for the Mets to make, if only because I don't think he'd have ever gotten a fair shake with the fans. I think Ruff would have been booed from day one, and he deserves a chance to make this work someplace else. Now, he was designated for assignment, which means that he may not wind up with the team, with the new team, rather. He could take a job in Syracuse. I don't think that's going to happen, though. Do you see any way that he winds up in Syracuse?
No. And I think, yeah, like we've touched on, that there was enough there last year with how he played against or hit against lefties specifically, that I think somebody will either take him off waivers or you know, end up with him on. I mean, he's not even making that much money by Major League Baseball standards. So I don't think the Mets will be able to trade him for anything, but I think somebody will take him off their hands. And I would be shocked, given the way things have gone, even if he did clear, he'd have the right to refuse the assignment. And I'd be shocked if he willingly went to AAA, unless he really thinks that the issues he dealt with over the last few months need a little more time to get worked out.
Right.
But I think that would be even more surprising than the Mets DFAing him.
Yes.
So
yeah, if he winds up going down to AAA, you know, working out his issues and then just mashing lefties, I mean, I would love that. That's a fun way for this story to end. I don't think it's how the story's going to end necessarily. So yeah, opening day happened. You know, a lot of times there's big stories that come out of opening day. I don't really think there was one. Scherzer was probably left in for an inning too long. One of my Buck Showalter pet peeves about him is just that I think he isn't quick enough to yank somebody sometimes, but that's okay. The Mets came back and won. You know, Pete and Canna didn't look fantastic at the plate. Neither did Escobar from the left-hand side. But, you know, the Mets managed to. They managed to outscore the Marlins. They looked pretty good overall. Brandon Nimmo had a nice double. Daniel Vogelbach went first to third and then scored standing up on a sack fly. So, you know, strange things did happen during the game. But overall, I thought it was, you know, a fun opening day, but one that's kind of unremarkable. Do you sort of agree with that?
Yeah, and I think if the Mets have a lot of days like that, that's a great season to be having.
Absolutely.
And this is a point that we make over and over, but you do not want to take for granted that you're going to beat the teams that you're supposed to beat, because even the Nationals will probably win 50-something or maybe even 60 games this year. And I know that the Mets don't face them in this first 8-game stretch without a day off. But when you're playing those teams you're supposed to beat, every one of those wins is still significant. And if you can just take care of business in those scenarios, you can withstand the harder stretches of the schedule that, you know, might come up. I think June this year, and we can talk schedule, you know, more as the season goes on. But there are some times when it's going to be very challenging for them to get through the course of a few weeks. So to have a kind of ho-hum win that you should win, and they face Sandy Alcantara. Like, it's not like they
right
you know, it's not like they had who Patrick Corbin started for the Nationals. There's a massive gap between last year's Cy Young winner and some of the starting pitchers that were thrown out there on opening day on some of the lesser teams around the league. So yeah, just doing what you're supposed to do, winning that kind of a game, and, you know, setting things up where if they win tonight, and there's no guarantee that they will, but you're looking at being able to win a series. And that was sort of the theme of last year. They went a very long time without losing one. And if you win all of your series, you're going to have a 100-win season.
Yeah,
or more. So long way to go, but I was perfectly content with the way that game went. And I do think, without reading too much into it, it was nice that the bullpen was just dominant.
Yes.
And the three innings of reliefs of Scherzer. So, yeah, here's to beating the Marlins three more times. And the Mets have a sort of unique thing coming up where they're part of three separate opening day itself, and then a home opener in Milwaukee on Monday, and then their own home opener on Thursday. So lots of ceremonies.
Yes, I totally forgot that Monday is another home. I was looking at the schedule and saying, why is there a 2 o'clock start on a Monday? And it was, because they're doing three home openers in a week. So this is what happens. But that's okay. Yeah. That's a fun thing. That should bring us right to our music picks for the week. So, Chris, what are you talking about?
So in my Tame Impala fandom, coming out of Desert Days last year, where they played Lonerism start to finish, and I think I had recommended that album years ago on our show. I was seeking music that was just really similar to that era of Tame Impala. And I was not familiar with Melody's Echo Chamber yet at all. But the first record that they had put out, it's really the stage name for, as we have the wonderful sounds of construction in New York City behind what I'm saying right now. But Melody's Echo Chamber was sort of the band name for Melody Prochet is the artist. And the first record, she collaborated quite a bit with Kevin Parker from Tame Impala in making. And I, you know, found that. It's from like 2012 or 13, and it's really good. kind of, you know, got me interested in her music. And she's playing in Brooklyn this weekend, a couple of sold out shows. Unfortunately, I'm going to be at one of them. So really looking forward to that show. And although it was the first record that got me hooked, I actually think start to finish, Bon Voyage is an album that she had put out in 2018. And it's just this like really good mix of like the opening track, especially it's like a 7-minute song. And especially as it goes on and kind of jams out a little bit, for me, it has some things that make me think of Wilco, who are in the midst of their Capitol Theater residency over these next few days. And, you know, to have notes of the style of music that Tame Impala has made, that's my favorite from their catalog, and, you know, influences that remind me of Wilco and several other bands. But those two just, you know, are kind of prominent in sort of how I came to it. Yeah, Bon Voyage kind of encapsulates all of that all at once. So very excited to get to see that show and to recommend one of her records this week. And, you know, start with the first one, I guess, maybe, if you haven't heard any of it. But I think the second is the best one so far. Yeah.
All right. I will definitely check that out. That's a an artist I have heard a lot about, but I've not actually checked out yet. So I will do that. So I am a big proponent, and longtime listeners will know this, of the Spotify Discover Weekly playlist, because they take what you listen to and they use their fancy algorithm to figure out new stuff you should hear. And there's stuff that happens a lot of times where you're like, I have no idea how they were able to figure out exactly that this is what I need to hear today, but they did. And one of those things was, so when Burt Bacharach died a number of months ago, I just went through and I was, that's a name I obviously knew. I have the record he did with Elvis Costello, and I'm aware of many of the pop hits he wrote for Dionne Warwick and others, but I sort of gave myself like a little education in Burt Bacharach music because I didn't realize the extent of his songwriting career, which is insane. That's a topic for another day, though. But so on the Discover Weekly a few weeks later, there was a track by an artist named Alejandro Bravo that was a cover of Always Something There to Remind Me, the Burt Bacharach Hal David song. And it's done with this like acoustic guitar and vocal style that sounds not dissimilar from So Jorge, Brazilian singer-songwriter who did a bunch of David Bowie songs for the Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou soundtrack. Just these like very sort of minimal acoustic guitar and vocal pieces. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. And so I checked out the full album, and it's one of these things that is only possible really on this scale in the time in which we live, which is that here's an album that was released in Mexico in, I want to say it's 1971. I'm checking that right now. And yeah, 71, never really did anything, at least on this side of the border, and went out of print forever. And then this year, the Numero Group, which is one of the best reissue labels in the world, reissued it just digitally. Not, you cannot buy a physical copy of it. If you go on Discogs, you'll see some old Mexican pressings of it that are way too expensive for my blood. But I guess it was found because Numero Group was doing, they did a compilation record that was a bunch of famous artists, or famous songs rather, being done by unknown artists. It's called Super Hits of the 70s, and that's very good also. But so this record has a couple of covers on it. It has this song I mentioned before, and also Superstar by the Carpenters, which is an interesting second cover to have on there. But the music sounds a lot like sort of like mid-period Jonathan Richman, when he postmodern lovers, pre-singing in Spanish, where he's just kind of telling stories and doing fun stuff. Like a lot of it sounds like that. It's super fun, and it's something I didn't no, I needed to hear. I listened to it consistently since then, and I actually sent the Numero group an email and was like, please issue this on vinyl. I want this so badly. And they said, no plans. But we'll see. Maybe if enough of you listen to this and like it and email them, they will release it on vinyl. So that is my pick, Alejandro Bravo's self-titled debut from 1971. So listen to it on your streaming platform of choice, or if you happen to find it in a thrift store in its original Mexican pressing and you want to get it to your favorite podcaster, just let me know. I'll send you my address. Anyway, thank you for listening, folks. We truly appreciate it. Go to homerunapplesauce.com. Join our Patreon. Listen to the other amazing podcasts. We have a new podcast starting next week. Can't wait for you to hear it. It's going to be super, super fun. We are proud to be part of the Fans First Sports Network. You can always still find our writing on AmazingAvenue.com. Chris is on Twitter @ChrisMcShane. I am on Twitter @BrianNeedsANap. And until next time, let's go Mets.